myself, and I'm much better at bringing out the best in others than in myself. That's just the kind of person I am. I'm the scratchy stuff on the side of the matchbox. But that's fine with me. I don't mind at all. Better to be a first-class matchbox than a second-class match. I got this clear in my own mind, I'd say, after I started teaching this girl. I had taught a few others when I was younger, strictly as a sideline, without realizing this about myself. It was only after I started teaching her that I began to think of myself that way. Hey, I'm good at teaching people. That's how well the lessons went. As I said yesterday, the girl was nothing special when it came to technique, and there was no question of her becoming a professional musician, so I could take it easy. Plus, she was going to the kind of girls' school where anybody with half-decent marks automatically got into university, which meant she didn't have to kill herself studying. And her mother was all for going easy with the lessons, too, so I didn't push her to do anything. I knew the first time I met her that she was the kind of girl you couldn't push to do anything. That she was the kind of child who would be all sweetness and say, "Yes, yes," and absolutely refuse to do anything she didn't want to do. So the first thing I did was let her play a piece the way she wanted to, 100% her own way. Then I would play the same piece several different ways for her, and the two of us would discuss which was best or which way she liked most. Then I'd have her play the piece again, and her performance would be 10 times better than the first. She would see for herself what worked best and bring those features into her own playing. Reiko paused for a moment, observing the glowing end of her cigarette. I went on eating my grapes without a word. I know I have a pretty good sense for music, but she was better than me. I used to think it was such a waste. I thought, if only she had started out with a good teacher and received the proper training, she'd be so much farther along. But I was wrong. She wasn't the kind of child who could stand proper training. There just happened to be people like that. They're blessed with this marvelous talent, but they can't make the effort to systematize it. They end up squandering it in little bits and pieces. I've seen my share of people like that. At first you think they're amazing. They can sight-read some terrifically difficult piece and do a damn good job playing it all the way through. You see them do it, and you're overwhelmed. You think, I could never do that in 1,000,000 years. But that's as far as it goes. They can't take it any further. And why not? Because they won't put in the effort. They haven't had the discipline pounded into them. They've been spoiled. They have just enough talent so they've been able to play things well without any effort, and they've had people telling them how great they are from an early age, so hard work looks stupid to them. They'll take some piece another kid has to work on for 3 weeks and polish it off in half the time. So the teacher assumes they've put enough into it and lets them go on to the next thing. And they do that in half the time, and go on to the next piece. They never find out what it means to be hammered by the teacher. They lose out on a crucial element required for character building. It's a tragedy. I myself had tendencies like that. But fortunately, I had a very tough teacher, so I kept them in check. Anyway, it was a joy to teach her. Like driving down the highway in a high-powered sports car that responds to the slightest touch. Responds too quickly sometimes. The trick to teaching children like that is not to praise them too much. They're so used to praise, it doesn't mean anything to them. You've got to dole it out wisely. And you can't force anything on them. You have to let them choose for themselves. And you don't let them rush ahead from one thing to the next. You make them stop and think. But that's about it. If you do those things, you'll get good results. Reiko dropped her cigarette butt on the floor and stamped it out. Then she took a deep breath, as if to calm herself. When her lessons ended, we'd have tea and chat. Sometimes I'd show her certain jazz piano styles, like this is Bud Powell, or this is Thelonious Monk. but mostly she talked. And what a talker she was. She could draw you right in. As I told you yesterday, I think most of what she said was made up, but it was interesting. She was a keen observer, a precise user of language, sharp-tongued and funny. She could stir your emotions. Yes, really, that's what she was so good at, stirring people's emotions, moving you. And she knew she had this power. She tried to use it as skillfully and effectively as possible. She could make you feel whatever she wanted, angry or sad or sympathetic or disappointed or happy. She would manipulate people's emotions for no other reason than to test her own powers. Of course, I only realized this later. At the time, I had no idea what she was doing to me. Reiko shook her head and ate a few grapes. "It was a sickness," she said. "The girl was sick. She was like the rotten apple that ruins all the other apples, and no one could cure her. She'll have that sickness until the day she dies. In that sense, she was a sad little creature. I would have pitied her, too, if I hadn't been one of her victims. I would have seen her as a victim." Reiko ate a few more grapes. She seemed to be thinking of how best to go on with her story. "Well, anyway, I enjoyed teaching her for a good 6 months. Sometimes I'd find something she said a little surprising or odd, or she'd be talking, and I'd have this rush of horror when I realized the intensity of her hatred for some person was completely irrational. Or it would occur to me that she was just far too clever, and I'd wonder what she was really thinking. But after all, everyone has their flaws, right? And finally, what business was it of mine to question her personality or character? I was just her piano teacher. All I had to care about was whether she practiced or not. And besides, the truth of the matter is that I liked her. I liked her a lot. Still, I was careful not to tell her anything too personal about myself. I just had this sixth sense that I'd better not talk about such things. She asked me hundreds of questions. She was dying to know more about me. But I only told her the most harmless stuff, like things about my childhood or where I'd gone to school, stuff like that. She said she wanted to know more about me, but I told her there was nothing to tell. I'd had a boring life. I had an ordinary husband, an ordinary child, and a ton of housework. "But I like you so much," she'd say, and look me right in the eye in this clingy sort of way. It sent a thrill through me when she did that. A nice thrill. But even so, I never told her more than I had to. And then one day, a day in May, I think it was, in the middle of her lesson, she said she felt sick. I saw she was pale and sweating, and asked if she wanted to go home. But she said she thought she'd feel better if she could just lie down for a while. So I took her, almost carried her, to the bedroom. We had such a small sofa, the bed was the only place she could lie down. She apologized for being a nuisance, but I assured her it was no bother, and asked if she wanted anything to drink. She said no. She just wanted me to stay near her, which I said I'd be glad to do. A few minutes later, she asked me to rub her back. She sounded as though she was really suffering, and she was sweating like mad. So I started to give her a good massage. Then she apologized and asked me if I'd mind taking off her bra, as it was hurting her. So I don't know. I did it. She was wearing a skin-tight blouse, and I had to unbutton that and reach behind and undo the bra hooks. She had big breasts for a 13-year-old, twice as big as mine. And she wasn't wearing any starter bra, but a real adult model, an expensive one. Of course, I'm not paying all that much attention at the time, and like an idiot, I just carry on rubbing her back. She keeps apologizing in this pitiful voice, as if she's really sorry, and I keep telling her it's okay, it's okay. Reiko tapped the ash from her cigarette to the floor. By then, I had stopped eating grapes and was giving all my attention to her story. After a while, she starts sobbing. "What's wrong?" I ask her. "Nothing," she says. "It's obviously not nothing," I say. "Tell me the truth. What's bothering you?" So she says, "I just get like this sometimes. I don't know what to do. I'm so lonely and sad, and I can't talk to anybody, and nobody cares about me. And it hurts so much. I just get like this. I can't sleep at night, and I don't feel like eating, and coming here for my lesson is the only thing I have to look forward to." So I say, "You can talk to me. Tell me why this happens to you." "Things are not going well at home," she says. "She can't love her parents, and they don't love her. Her father is seeing another woman and is hardly ever around, and that makes her mother half crazy, and she takes it out on the girl. She beats her almost every day, and she hates to go home." So now the girl is really wailing, and her eyes are full of tears. Those beautiful eyes of hers. The sight is enough to make a god weep. So I tell her if it's so terrible to go home, she can come to my place any time she likes. When she hears that, the girl throws her arms around me and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, but if I didn't have you, I wouldn't know what to do. Please don't turn your back on me. If you did that, I'd have nowhere to go." So, I don't know. I hold her head against me, and I'm caressing her and saying, "There, there." And she's got her arms around me, and she's stroking my back. And soon I'm starting to feel very strange. My whole body is kind of hot. I mean, here's this picture-perfect, beautiful girl, and I'm on the bed with her, and we're hugging, and her hands are caressing my back in this incredibly sensual way that my own husband couldn't even begin to match. And I feel all the screws coming loose in my body every time she touches me. And before I know it, she has my blouse and bra off, and she's stroking my breasts. So that's when it finally hits me that she's an absolute dyed-in-the-wool lesbian. This had happened to me once before at school. One of the sixth-form girls. So then I tell her to stop. "Oh, please," she says, "just a little more. I'm so lonely. I'm so lonely. Please believe me, you're the only one I have. Oh, please, don't turn your back on me." And she takes my hand and puts it on her breast. Her very nicely shaped breast. And, sure, I'm a woman. But this electric something goes through me when my hand makes contact. I have no idea what to do. I just keep repeating no, 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 like an idiot. It's as if I'm paralyzed. I can't move. I had managed to push the girl away at school, but now I can't do a thing. My body won't take orders. She's holding my right hand against her with her left hand, and she's kissing and licking my nipples. And her right hand is caressing my back, my side, my bottom. So here I am in the bedroom with the curtains closed, and a 13-year-old girl has me practically naked, she's been taking my clothes off somehow all along, and touching me all over, and I'm writhing with the pleasure of it. Looking back on it now, it seems incredible. I mean, it's insane, don't you think? But at the time, it was as if she had cast a spell on me. Reiko paused to puff at her cigarette. "You know, this is the first time I've ever told a man about it," she said, looking at me. "I'm telling it to you because I think I ought to, but I'm finding it really embarrassing." "I'm sorry," I said, because I didn't know what else to say. This went on for a while, and then her right hand started to move down, and she touched me through my panties. By then, I was absolutely soaking wet. I'm ashamed to say it, but I've never been so wet before or since. I had always thought of myself as sort of indifferent to sex, so I was astounded to be getting so worked up. So then she puts these slim, soft fingers of hers inside my panties and... well, you know, I can't bring myself to put it into words. I mean, it was totally different from when a man puts his clumsy hands on you there. It was amazing. Really. Like feathers or down. I thought all the fuses in my head were going to pop. Still, somewhere in my fogged-over brain, the thought occurred to me that I had to put a stop to this. If I let it happen once, I'd never stop. And if I had to carry around a secret like that inside me, my head was going to get completely messed up again. I thought about my daughter, too. What if she saw me like this? She was supposed to be at my parents' house until 3 on Saturdays, but what if something happened and she came home unexpectedly? This helped me to gather my strength and raise myself on the bed. "Stop it now! Please stop!" I shouted. But she wouldn't stop. Instead, she yanked my panties down and started using her tongue. I had rarely let even my husband do that. I found it so embarrassing. But now I had a 13-year-old girl licking me all over down there. I just gave up. All I could do was cry. And it was absolute paradise. "Stop it!" I yelled one more time, and slapped her on the side of the face as hard as I could. She finally stopped, raised herself up, and looked into my eyes. The two of us were stark naked on our knees in bed, staring at each other. She was 13, I was 31. But I don't know, looking at that body of hers, I felt totally overwhelmed. The image is still so vivid in my mind. I could hardly believe I was looking at the body of a 13-year-old girl, and I still can't believe it. By comparison, what I had for a body was enough to make you cry, believe me. There was nothing I could say, and so I said nothing. "What's wrong?" she says to me. "You like it this way, don't you? I knew you would the first time I met you. I know you like it. It's much better than doing it with a man, isn't it? Look how wet you are. I can make you feel even better if you'll let me. It's true. I can make you feel like your body's melting away. You want me to, don't you?" And she was right. She was much better than my husband. And I did want her to do it even more. But I couldn't let it happen. "Let's do this once a week," she said. "Just once a week. Nobody will find out. It'll be our little secret." But I got out of bed and put on my dressing gown and told her to leave and never come back. She just looked at me. Her eyes were absolutely flat. I had never seen them like that before. It was as if they were painted on cardboard. They had no depth. After she stared at me for a while, she gathered up her clothes without a word and, as slowly as she could, as though she were making a show of it, she put on each item, one at a time. Then she went back into the piano room and took a brush from her bag. She brushed her hair and wiped the blood from her lips with a handkerchief, put on her shoes and left. As she went out, she said, "You're a lesbian, you know. It's true. You may try to hide it, but you'll be a lesbian until the day you die."
"Is it true?" I asked.
Reiko curved her lips and thought for a while. "Well, it is and it isn't. I definitely felt better with her than with my husband, that's a fact. I had a time there when I really agonized over the question. Maybe I really was a lesbian and just hadn't noticed until then. But I don't think so anymore. Which is not to say I don't have the tendencies. I probably do have them. But I'm not a lesbian in the proper sense of the term. I never feel desire when I look at a woman, know what I mean?
I nodded.
Certain kinds of girls, though, do respond to me, and I can feel it when that happens. Those are the only times it comes out in me. I can hold Naoko in my arms, though, and feel nothing special. We go around in the flat practically naked when the weather's hot, and we take baths together, sometimes even sleep in the same bed, but nothing happens. I don't feel a thing. I can see that she has a beautiful body, but that's all. Actually, Naoko and I played a game once. We made believe we were lesbians. Want to hear about it?
Sure. Tell me.
When I told her the story I just told you, we tell each other everything, you know. Naoko tried an experiment. The two of us got undressed, and she tried caressing me. But it didn't work at all. It just tickled. I thought I was going to die laughing. Just thinking about it makes me itchy. She was so clumsy. I'll bet you're glad to hear that.
Yes, I am, to tell the truth.
Well, anyway, that's about it,
said Reiko, scratching near an eyebrow with the tip of her little finger.
After the girl left my house, I found a chair and sat there spacing out for a while, wondering what to do. I could hear the dull beating of my heart from deep inside my body. My arms and legs seemed to weigh a ton, and my mouth felt as though I'd eaten a moth or something, it was so dry. But I dragged myself to the bathroom, knowing my daughter would be back soon. I wanted to clean those places where the girl had touched and licked me. I scrubbed myself with soap over and over, but I couldn't seem to get rid of the slimy feeling she had left behind. I knew I was probably imagining it, but that didn't help. That night, I asked my husband to make love to me, almost as a way to get rid of the defilement.
Of course, I didn't tell him anything. I couldn't.
All I said to him was that I wanted him to take it slow, to give it more time than usual, and he did. He concentrated on every little detail. He really took a long, long time, and the way I came that night, oh yes, it was like nothing I had ever experienced before, never once in all our married life. And why do you think that was? Because the touch of that girl's fingers was still there in my body. That's all it was.
Oh, man, is this embarrassing? Look, I'm sweating. I can't believe I'm saying these things. He made love to me. I came.
Reiko smiled. Her lips curved again.
But even this didn't help. 2 days went by. 3. And her touch was still there. And her last words were echoing and echoing in my head. She didn't come to my house the following Saturday. My heart was pounding all day long while I waited, wondering what I would do if she showed up. I couldn't concentrate on anything. She never did come, though. Of course. She was a proud little thing, and she had failed with me in the end. She didn't come the next week either, nor the week after that, and soon a month went by. I decided that I would be able to forget about what had happened when enough time had passed. But I couldn't forget. When I was alone in the house, I would feel her presence, and my nerves would be on edge. I couldn't play the piano. I couldn't think. I couldn't do anything during that first month. And then one day I realized that something was wrong whenever I left the house. The neighbors were looking at me in a strange way. There was a new distance in their eyes. They were as polite as ever with their greetings, but there was something different in their tone of voice and in their behavior towards me. The woman next door, who used to pay me an occasional visit, seemed to be avoiding me. I tried not to let these things bother me, though. Start noticing things like that, and you've got the first signs of illness. Then one day I had a visit from another housewife I was on friendly terms with. We were the same age, and she was the daughter of a friend of my mother's, and her child went to the same kindergarten as mine, so we were fairly close. She just showed up one day and asked me if I knew about a terrible rumor that was going around about me. "What kind of rumor?" I asked. "I almost can't say it. It's so awful," she said. "Well, you've got this far. You have to tell me the rest." Still, she resisted telling me, but I finally got it all out of her. I mean, her whole purpose in coming to see me was to tell me what she had heard, so of course she was going to spit it out eventually. According to her, people were saying that I was a card-carrying lesbian and had been in and out of mental hospitals for it. They said that I had stripped the clothes off my piano pupil and tried to do things to her, and when she had resisted, I had slapped her so hard her face swelled up. They had turned the story on its head, of course, which was bad enough. But what really shocked me was that people knew I had been hospitalized. My friend said she was telling everyone that she had known me forever, and that I was not like that. But the girl's parents believed her version, and were spreading it around the neighborhood. In addition, they had investigated my background and found that I had a history of mental problems. The way my friend heard it, the girl had come home from her lesson one day, that day, of course, with her face all bloated, her lips split and bloody, buttons missing from her blouse, and even her underwear torn. Can you believe it? She had done all this to back up her story, of course, which her mother had to drag out of her. I can just see her doing it. Putting blood on her blouse, tearing buttons off, ripping the lace on her bra, making herself cry until her eyes were red, messing up her hair, telling her mother a pack of lies. Not that I'm blaming people for believing her. I would have believed her too, this beautiful doll with a devil's tongue. She comes home crying. She refuses to talk because it's too embarrassing. But then she spills it out. Of course people are going to believe her. And to make matters worse, it's true. I do have a history of hospitalization for mental problems. I did hit her in the face as hard as I could. Who's going to believe me? Probably just my husband. A few more days went by while I wrestled with the question of whether to tell him or not. But when I did, he believed me. Of course. I told him everything that had happened that day. The kind of lesbian thing she did to me. The way I slapped her in the face. Of course I didn't tell him what I had felt. I couldn't have told him that. So anyway, he was furious and insisted that he was going to go straight to the girl's family. He said, "You're a married woman after all. You're married to me. And you're a mother. There's no way you're a lesbian. What a joke." But I wouldn't let him go. All he could do was make things worse. I knew she was sick. I had seen hundreds of sick people, so I knew. The girl was rotten inside. Peel off a layer of that beautiful skin, and you'd find nothing but rotten flesh. I know it's a terrible thing to say, but it's true. And I knew that ordinary people could never know the truth about her. That there was no way we could win. She was an expert at manipulating the emotions of the adults around her, and we had nothing to prove our case. First of all, who's going to believe that a 13-year-old girl set a homosexual trap for a woman in her 30s? No matter what we said, people would believe what they wanted to believe. The more we struggled, the more vulnerable we'd be. There was only one thing for us to do, I said. We had to move. If I stayed in that neighborhood any longer, the stress would get to me, my mind would snap again. It was happening already. We had to get out of there, go somewhere far away where nobody knew me. My husband wasn't ready to go, though. It hadn't dawned on him yet how critical I was. And the timing was terrible. He loved his work. and he had finally succeeded in getting us settled in our own house. We lived in a little prefab, and our daughter was comfortable in her kindergarten.
"Wait a minute," he said. "We can't just up sticks and go. I can't find a job just like that.
We'd have to sell the house, and we'd have to find another kindergarten. It'll take 2 months at least." "I can't wait 2 months," I told him. "This is going to finish me off once and for all. I'm not kidding. Believe me, I know what I'm talking about."
The symptoms were starting already. My ears were ringing, and I was hearing things, and I couldn't sleep.
So he suggested that I leave first, go somewhere by myself, and he would follow after he had taken care of what had to be done.
"No," I said. "I don't want to go alone. I'll fall apart if I don't have you. I need you. Please don't leave me alone."
He held me and pleaded with me to hang on a little longer. "Just a month," he said. He would take care of everything. Leave his job, sell the house, make arrangements for kindergarten, find a new job. There might be a position he could take in Australia, he said. He just wanted me to wait 1 month, and everything would be okay.
What could I say to that? If I tried to object, it would only isolate me even more.
Reiko sighed and looked at the ceiling light.
I couldn't hold on for a month, though. One day it happened again. Snap! And this time it was really bad. I took sleeping pills and turned on the gas. I woke up in a hospital bed, and it was all over. It took a few months before I had calmed down enough to think. And then I asked my husband for a divorce. I told him it would be the best thing for him and for our daughter. He said he had no intention of divorcing me. "We can make a new start," he said. "We can go somewhere new, just the three of us, and begin all over again." "It's too late," I told him. "Everything ended when you asked me to wait a month. If you really wanted to start again, you shouldn't have said that to me. Now, no matter where we go, no matter how far away we move, the same thing will happen all over again. And I'll ask you for the same thing and make you suffer. I don't want to do that anymore." And so we divorced. Or I should say I divorced him. He married again 2 years ago, though. I'm still glad I made him leave me, really. I knew I'd be like this for the rest of my life, and I didn't want to drag anyone down with me. I didn't want to force anyone to live in constant fear that I might lose my mind at any moment. He had been wonderful to me, an ideal husband, faithful, strong and patient, someone I could put my complete trust in. He had done everything he could to heal me. And I had done everything I could to be healed, both for his sake and for our daughter's. And I had believed in my recovery. I was happy for 6 years from the time we were married. He got me 99% of the way there. But the other 1% went crazy. Snap! Everything we had built up came crashing down. In one split second, everything turned into nothing. And that girl was the one who did it. Reiko collected the cigarette butts she had crushed underfoot and tossed them into the tin can. "It's a terrible story. We worked so hard, building our world one brick at a time. And when it fell apart, it happened just like that. Everything was gone before you knew it."
She stood up and thrust her hands in her pockets. "Let's go back. It's late." The sky was darker, the cloud cover thicker than before, the moon invisible. Now I realized, like Reiko, I could smell the rain, and with it mixed the fresh smell of the grapes in the bag I was holding. "That's why I can't leave this place," she said. I'm afraid to get involved with the outside world. I'm afraid to meet new people and feel new feelings.
I understand, I said, but I think you can do it. I think you can go outside and make it. Reiko smiled, but said nothing. Naoko was on the sofa with a book. She had her legs crossed and pressed her hand against her temple as she read. Her fingers almost seemed to be touching and testing each word that entered her head. Scattered drops of rain were beginning to tap on the roof. The lamplight enveloped her, hovering around her like fine dust. After my long talk with Reiko, Naoko's youthfulness struck me in a new way.
"Sorry we're so late," said Reiko, patting Naoko's head. "Enjoy yourselves?" asked Naoko, looking up.
"Of course," said Reiko.
"Doing what?"
Naoko asked me.
"Just the two of you?"
"Not at liberty to say, miss," I answered. Naoko chuckled and set down her book. Then the three of us ate grapes to the sound of the rain.
"When it's raining like this," said Naoko, "it feels as if we're the only ones in the world. I wish it would just keep raining so the three of us could stay together."
"Oh, sure," said Reiko. "And while the two of you are going at it, I'm supposed to be fanning you or playing background music on my guitar like some dumb geisha? No thanks."
"Oh, I'd let you have him once in a while," said Naoko, laughing.
"Okay, then. Count me in," said Reiko. "Come on, rain, pour down."
The rain did pour down, and kept pouring. Thunder shook the place from time to time. When we had finished the grapes, Reiko went back to her cigarettes and pulled out the guitar from under her bed and started to play. First Desafinado, and the girl from Ipanema, then some Bacharach and a few Lennon and McCartney songs. Reiko and I sipped wine again, and when that was gone, we shared the brandy that was left in my flask. A warm, intimate mood took hold as the three of us talked into the night, and I began to wish, with Naoko, that the rain would keep on falling.
"Will you come to see me again?"
she asked, looking at me.
"Of course I will," I said.
"And will you write?"
"Every week."
"And will you add a few lines for me?"
asked Reiko. "That I will," I said. "I'd be glad to." At 11 o'clock, Reiko unfolded the sofa and made a bed for me as she had the night before. We said good night and turned out the lights. Unable to sleep, I took the magic mountain and a torch from my rucksack and read for a while. Just before midnight, the bedroom door edged open and Naoko came and crawled in next to me. Unlike the night before, Naoko was the usual Naoko. Her eyes were in focus, her movements brisk. Bringing her mouth to my ear, she whispered,
"I don't know. I can't sleep."
"I can't either," I said. Setting my book down and turning out the torch, I took her in my arms and kissed her. The darkness and the sound of the rain enfolded us.
"How about Reiko?" "Don't worry. She's sound asleep. And when she sleeps, she sleeps."
Then Naoko asked,
"Will you really come to see me again?"
"Of course I will."
"Even if I can't do anything for you?"
I nodded in the darkness. I could feel the full shape of her breasts against me. I traced the outline of her body through her gown with the flat of my hand. From shoulder to back to hips, I ran my hand over her again and again, driving the line and the softness of her body into my brain. After we had been in this gentle embrace for a while, Naoko touched her lips to my forehead and slipped out of bed. I could see her pale blue gown flash in the darkness like a fish.
"Goodbye,"
she called in a tiny voice.
Listening to the rain, I dropped into a gentle sleep. It was still raining the following morning, a fine, almost invisible autumn rain, unlike the previous night's downpour. You knew it was raining only because of the ripples on puddles and the sound of dripping from the eaves. I woke to see a milky white mist enclosing the window, but as the sun rose, a breeze carried the mist away, and the surrounding woods and hills began to emerge. As we had done the day before, the three of us ate breakfast, then went out to attend to the aviary. Nalco and Reiko wore yellow plastic rain capes with hoods. I put on a jumper and a waterproof wind cheater. Outside, the air was damp and chilly. The birds, too, were avoiding the rain, huddled together at the back of the cage. "Gets cold here when it rains, doesn't it?" I said to Reiko. "Every time it rains, it'll be a little colder now, until it turns to snow," she said. "The clouds from the Sea of Japan dump tons of snow when they pass through here." "What do you do with the birds in the winter?"
"Bring them inside, of course."
"What are we supposed to do? Dig them out of the snow in spring all frozen? We defrost him and bring him back to life and yell, 'Okay, everybody, come and get it.'" I poked the wire mesh, and the parrot flapped its wings and squawked,
"Shithead! Thank you! Crazy!"
"Now that one I'd like to freeze," Nalco said with a melancholy look. "I really think I will go crazy if I have to hear that every morning."
After cleaning the aviary, we went back to the flat. While I packed my things, the women put on their farm clothes. We left the building together and parted just beyond the tennis court. They turned right and I continued straight ahead. We called goodbye to each other, and I promised I would come again. Nalco gave a little smile and disappeared around a corner. On my way to the gate, I passed several people, all wearing the same yellow rain capes that Nalco and Reiko wore, all with their hoods up. Colors shone with an exceptional clarity in the rain. The ground was a deep black, the pine branches a brilliant green, and the people wrapped in yellow, looking like otherworldly spirits that were only allowed to wander the earth on rainy mornings. They floated over the ground in silence, carrying farm tools, baskets, and sacks. The gatekeeper remembered my name and marked it on the list of visitors as I left.
"I see you're here from Tokyo," the old fellow said. "I went there once. Just once. They serve great pork."
"They do?" I asked, uncertain how to answer him.
"I didn't like much of what I ate in Tokyo, but the pork was delicious. I expect they have some special way of rearing 'em, huh?"
I said I didn't know. It was the first I'd heard of it. "When was that, by the way, when you went to Tokyo?"
"Let's see," he said, cocking his head. "Was it the time His Majesty the Crown Prince got married? My son was in Tokyo and said I ought to see the place at least once. That must have been 1959.
"Oh, well then, sure, pork must have been good in Tokyo back then," I said.
"How about these days?" he asked.
"I wasn't sure," I said, but I hadn't heard anything special about it. This seemed to disappoint him. He gave every sign of wanting to continue our conversation, but I told him I had to catch a bus and started walking in the direction of the road. Patches of fog remained floating on the path where it skirted the stream, but the breeze carried them over to the steep flanks of a nearby mountain. Every now and then, as I walked along, I would stop, turn, and heave a deep sigh for no particular reason. I felt as though I had arrived on a planet where the gravity was a little different.
"Yes, of course," I told myself, feeling sad. I was in the outside world now.
Back at the dorm by 4:30, I changed straight away and left for the record shop in Shinjuku to put in my hours. I looked after the shop from 6 o'clock to 10:30 and sold a few records. But mainly I sat there in a daze, watching an incredible variety of people streaming by outside. There were families and couples and drunks and gangsters and lively-looking girls in short skirts and bearded hippies and bar hostesses and some indefinable types. Whenever I put on hard rock, hippies and runaway kids would gather outside to dance and sniff paint thinner, or just sit on the ground doing nothing in particular. And when I put on Tony Bennett, they would disappear. Next door was a shop where a middle-aged, sleepy-eyed man sold adult toys. I couldn't imagine why anyone would want the kind of sex paraphernalia he had there, but he seemed to do a roaring trade. In the alley diagonally across from the record shop, I saw a drunken student vomiting. In the game arcade across from us at another angle, the cook from a local restaurant was killing time on his break with a game of bingo that took cash bets. Beneath the eaves of a shop that had closed for the night, a swarthy homeless guy was crouching, motionless. A girl with pale pink lipstick, who couldn't have been more than 12 or 13, came in and asked me to play the Rolling Stones' Jumpin' Jack Flash. When I found the record and put it on for her, she started snapping her fingers to the rhythm and shaking her hips as she danced around the shop. Then she asked me for a cigarette. I gave her one of the manager's, which she smoked gratefully. And when the record ended, she left the shop without so much as a thank you. Every 15 minutes or so, I would hear the siren of an ambulance or police car. Three drunk company executives in suits and ties came by, laughing at the top of their voices every time they yelled, "Nice ass!" at a pretty long-haired girl in a phone box. The more I watched, the more confused I became. What the hell was this all about? I wondered. What could it possibly mean? The manager came back from dinner and said to me, "Hey, know what, Watanabe? Night before last, I made it with the boutique chick." For some time now, he had had his eye on the girl who worked at a boutique nearby, and every once in a while he would take a record from the shop as a gift for her. "Good for you," I said to him, whereupon he told me every last detail of his conquest. "If you really want to make a chick, here's what you got to do," he began, very pleased with himself. "First, you got to give her presents. Then you gotta get her drunk. I mean really drunk. Then you just gotta do it. It's easy. See what I mean?" Head mixed up as ever, I boarded the commuter train and went back to my dorm. Closing the curtains, I turned off the lights, stretched out in bed, and felt as if Naoko might come crawling in beside me at any moment. With my eyes closed, I could feel the soft swell of her breasts on my chest, hear her whispering to me, and feel the outline of her body in my hands. In the darkness, I returned to that small world of hers. I smelled the meadow grass, heard the rain at night. I thought of her naked, as I had seen her in the moonlight, and pictured her cleaning the aviary and tending to the vegetables with that soft, beautiful body of hers wrapped in the yellow rain cape. Clutching my erection, I thought of Naoko until I came. This seemed to clear my brain a little, but it didn't help me sleep. I felt exhausted, desperate for sleep, but it simply refused to cooperate. I got out of bed and stood at the window, my unfocused eyes wandering out towards the flagpole. Without the national flag attached to it, the pole looked like a gigantic white bone thrusting up into the darkness of night. What was Naoko doing now, I wondered. Of course, she must be sleeping. Sleeping deeply. Shrouded in the darkness of that curious little world of hers. Let her be spared from anguished dreams, I found myself hoping. Chapter 7. In P.E. class the next morning, Thursday,
I swam several lengths of the 50-meter pool. The vigorous exercise cleared my head some more and gave me an appetite. After eating a good-sized lunch at a student restaurant known for its good-sized lunches, I was on my way to the literature department library to do some research when I bumped into Midori Kobayashi. She had someone with her, a petite girl with glasses. But when she spotted me, she approached me alone. "Where are you going?" she asked.
"Lit library," I said.
"Why don't you forget it and come have lunch with me?"
"I've already eaten."
"So what? Eat again."
We ended up going to a nearby cafe, where she had a plate of curry and I had a cup of coffee. She wore a white long-sleeve shirt under a yellow woolen vest, with a fish knitted into the design, a narrow gold necklace, and a Disney watch. She seemed to enjoy the curry and drank three glasses of water with it.
"Where have you been?"
Midori asked.
"I don't know how many times I called."
"Was there something you wanted to talk about?"
"Nothing special. I just called."
"I see."
"You see what?"
"Nothing. Just, I see," I said. "Any fires lately?"
"That was fun, wasn't it? It didn't do much damage, but all that smoke made it feel real. Great stuff."
Midori gulped another glass of water, took a breath, and studied my face for a while.
"Hey, what's wrong with you?" she asked. "You've got this spaced-out face. Your eyes aren't focused."
"I'm okay," I said. "I just came back from a trip, and I'm tired."
"You look like you've just seen a ghost."
"I see."
"Hey, do you have lectures this afternoon?"
"German and RE."
"Can you skip 'em?"
"Not German. I've got a test today."
"When's it over?"
2.
"Okay. How about going into the city with me after that for some drinks?"
"At 2 in the afternoon?"
"For a change, why not? You look so spaced. Come on. Come drinking with me and get a little life into you. That's what I want to do. Drink with you and get some life into myself. What do you say?"
"Okay, let's go," I said with a sigh. "I'll look for you in the lit quad at 2. After German, we caught a bus to Shinjuku and went to an underground bar called Doug, behind the Kinokuniya bookshop. We each started with 2 vodka and tonics.
"I come here once in a while," she said. "They don't make you feel embarrassed to be drinking in the afternoon."
"Do you drink in the afternoon a lot?"
"Sometimes," she said, rattling the ice in her glass. "Sometimes when the world gets too hard to live in, I come here for a vodka and tonic."
"Does the world get hard to live in?"
"Sometimes," said Midori. "I've got my own special little problems."
"Like what?"
"Like family, like boyfriends, like irregular periods. Stuff."
"So have another drink."
"I will."
I beckoned to the waiter and ordered 2 more vodka and tonics.
"Remember how, when you came over that Sunday, you kissed me?" Midori asked. "I've been thinking about it. It was nice. Really nice."
"That's nice."
"That's nice," she mimicked. "The way you talk is so weird."
"It is?"
"Anyway, I was thinking that time. I was thinking how great it would be if that had been the first time in my life a boy had kissed me. If I could switch around the order of my life, I would absolutely, absolutely make that my first kiss. And then I would live the rest of my life thinking stuff like, 'Hey, I wonder whatever happened to that boy named Watanabe I gave my first kiss to on the laundry deck now that he's 58. Wouldn't that be great?'"
"Yeah, really," I said, cracking a pistachio nut.
"Hey, what is it with you? Why are you so spaced out? You still haven't answered me."
"I probably still haven't completely adapted to the world," I said, after giving it some thought. "I don't know. I feel like this isn't the real world. The people, the scene, they just don't seem real to me."
Midori rested an elbow on the bar and looked at me.
There was something like that in a Jim Morrison song, I'm pretty sure.
People are strange when you're a stranger?
Peace,
said Midori.
Peace,
I said.
You really ought to go to Uruguay with me,
Midori said, still leaning on the bar.
Girlfriend, family, university, just dump 'em all.
Not a bad idea, I said, laughing.
Don't you think it would be wonderful to get rid of everything and everybody and just go somewhere where you don't know a soul? Sometimes I feel like doing that. I really, really want to do it sometimes. Like suppose you whisked me somewhere far, far away. I'd make lots of babies for you as tough as little bulls. And we'd all live happily ever after, rolling on the floor.
I laughed and drank my third vodka and tonic.
I guess you don't really want lots of babies as tough as little bulls yet, said Midori.
I'm intrigued, I said. I'd like to see what they looked like.
That's okay. You don't have to want them, said Midori, eating a pistachio. Here I am, drinking in the afternoon, saying whatever pops into my head. I want to dump everything and run off somewhere. What's the point of going to Uruguay? All they've got there is donkey shit.
You may be right.
Donkey shit everywhere. Here is shit, there is shit, the whole world is donkey shit. Hey, I can't open this, you take it.
Midori handed me a pistachio nut. I struggled with it until I cracked it open.
But oh, what a relief it was last Sunday. Going up to the laundry deck with you, watching the fire, drinking beer, singing songs. I don't know how long it's been since I had such a total sense of relief. People are always trying to force stuff on me. The minute they see me, they start telling me what to do. At least you don't try to force stuff on me.
I don't know you well enough to force stuff on you.
You mean if you knew me better, you'd force stuff on me like everyone else?
It's possible, I said. That's how people live in the real world, forcing stuff on each other.
You wouldn't do that. I can tell. I'm an expert when it comes to forcing stuff and having stuff forced on you. You're not the type. That's why I can relax with you. Do you have any idea how many people there are in the world who like to force stuff on people and have stuff forced on them? Tons! And then they make a big fuss like, I forced her. You forced me. That's what they like. But I don't like it. I just do it because I have to.
What kind of stuff do you force on people, or they force on you?
Midori put an ice cube in her mouth and sucked on it for a while.
Do you want to get to know me better?
She asked.
Yeah, kind of. Hey, look, I just asked you, do you want to get to know me better? What sort of answer is that?
Yes, Midori, I would like to get to know you better, I said.
Really?
Yes, really.
Even if you had to turn your eyes away from what you saw?
Are you that bad?
Well, in a way,
Midori said with a frown.
I want another drink.
I called the waiter and ordered a fourth round of drinks.
Until they came, Midori cupped her chin in her hand with her elbow on the bar. I kept quiet and listened to Thelonious Monk playing Honeysuckle Rose. There were five or six other customers in the place, but we were the only ones drinking alcohol. The rich smell of coffee gave the gloomy interior an intimate atmosphere.
Are you free this Sunday?
Midori asked.
I think I told you before. I'm always free on Sunday, until I go to work at 6.
Okay, then, this Sunday, will you hang out with me?
Sure, I said.
I'll pick you up at your dorm Sunday morning. I'm not sure exactly what time, though. Is that okay?
Fine, I said. No problem.
Now let me ask you, do you have any idea what I would like to do right now?
I can't imagine.
Well, first of all, I want to lie down in a big, wide, fluffy bed. I want to get all comfy and drunk and not have any donkey shit anywhere nearby. And I want to have you lying down next to me. And then, little by little, you take off my clothes so tenderly. The way a mother undresses a little child, so softly.
Hmm.
and I'm just spacing out and feeling really nice until all of a sudden I realize what's happening, and I yell at you, "Stop it!"